So, Martin, do you know how many archaeologists it takes to change a light bulb?
This sounds like the beginning of a joke, and no, I don't.
It is indeed a joke, and neither do we, because we haven't got enough evidence yet.
Oh, no.
It's a terrible joke. It's a terrible joke, but it does somehow kind of encapsulate a deeper truth, I like to think. We spend our days always trying to get more and more and more evidence, and we will never finish, which makes it an ideal career.
I like it. Informative and funny. How brilliant.
That's very kind of you. Anyway, welcome to the Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast. I'm Martin Williams. That is Helen Geek. Helen is a real archaeologist. What are you working on at the moment, Helen? Prove you're a real archaeologist?
Well, you know, my day job is working on finds that have been reported under the Treasure Act in Norfolk. Mm-hmm. As part of that, I've been working over the last week on a couple of really interesting hoards. I've got one in at the moment that's a kind of mix of coins from the Iron Age, British Iron Age coins, and Roman Republican coins, and the other one is a hoard of Bronze Age spearheads. Now, both of these are really outside my core expertise, and that's what makes this job so fascinating, that there's always something new, something exciting to learn about.
And that, I think, is a really good analogy for what this podcast is going to be about. There's your proof. Helen is definitely an archaeologist and she knows what she's talking about. I am very much not an archaeologist, but I really, really want to learn, and I'm hoping to do that with you through this podcast. Helen's going to be answering the archaeology questions that you've always wanted to know, but you've maybe been too afraid to ask. That is one of the things that's coming up. Here's something else.
Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, is going to explain how the idea for Time Team came about.
You can find out how to get the most out of researching your own family tree. This is something so many people want to do, but how do you do it even better than you're doing it at the moment? We'll find out with Time Team's ancestry and genealogy expert, Dr. Sophie Kay, will join us.
And you're going to hear from someone who's part of a team uncovering the very boards trod by Shakespeare himself after they were discovered in an English medieval guild hall that then became a theatre.
First, though, I want to catch up with Stuart Ainsworth.
Now, Stuart is Time Team's landscape archaeologist, and over the next few episodes, you're going to be joining Stuart because he's going to be using various techniques to investigate a site of potential archaeological interest, and you can follow him as he goes. Now, first up, it's the simple map, how that can reveal so much hidden detail about landscapes of the past. And Martin, you've been to see Stuart at his base at the University of Chester, haven't you, where he's been exploring his collection with you.
I'm just looking through all these maps, a great big bundle of maps, Stuart, that you have in the corner of your office. What are all these?
Well, most people have furniture. I just have maps here. I've got literally hundreds of maps in here of different periods, of different places. Maps for a landscape archaeologist are their bread and butter.
Well, let's look at some of them. I mean, the first one I can see that's out here already is one I recognise. This is a normal OS map. I've used these when I've been going hiking. When you're examining a landscape, where do you start then when it comes to looking at all of these maps?
I always start with a modern map. And these maps contain a vast amount of information related to lost landscapes, as well as showing you what's on the modern landscape. For instance, the first thing I would do when I look at a map is look at the patterns of things, not detail. Landscapes are made up of hedgerows, field walls, roads, railways, all that kind of thing. Everything that humans have done on the landscape creates a different pattern. These patterns of roads are often clues to what the historic pattern of roads were. They've just been built in the same places in lots of cases. You've got patterns of fields. If you look closely, you can see that some things are very very straight. This is indicative of an area that's been divided up into very regular fields, probably in the late 18th or early 19th century, part of an enclosure process. But either side of it, can you see how the fields are small and curvy? That particular shape there that I've got my finger on.
Oh, kind of wavy shape?
It did. It looks like a wave. And that's exactly what it is. If we'd look at that on the ground, I would bet you pound to a penny that that is indicative of a medieval ploughland, because that's exactly the pattern I would be looking for a landscape feature called ridge and furrow ploughing.
You're looking at these patterns then on the modern map, on the Ordnance Survey. Where do these older ones come in?
These, what I really like, it's like this is like touching the past. Unrolling an old map, for me, is like reading a story from the past.
This is such an old one. It's like a treasure map almost.
These are lovely. This is actually the same area of Chester. If I move that one over there and put this one next to it. I've got to be a bit careful because bits do tend to drop off if you're not careful. It's a first edition Ordnance Survey map. This is Chester. In 1842, it was literally no bigger than the Roman legionary fortress, which was here. You can see all across this landscape as if you're looking at it in 1842. Look at the modern map, look at an older map, immediately see what's changed. Also, I've got to keep another... Can I show you another one?
Yeah, of course,
Because I don't get these out very often, Martin, and I love this process from rolling. This has got mould on it. Look, it's...
This is properly ancient, this one.
If you could hold that
I
side.
Yeah, I can hold this side.
My father used to be a decorator. I've got used to unrolling rolls of wallpaper. And look as I unfurl it, you've got the Altrincham Union Workhouse, House of Correction. Just unlocking this map here is telling you a story of a whole period in the late 19th century of attitudes to the working class, towards crime. These maps are an incredible statement of not just what's on the landscape, but social attitudes. Every map, in a way, has a story that could go along with it.
It's amazing listening to Stuart, isn't it? It's like listening to an art historian talking about old masters. You know, he started his career working for the Ordnance Survey. His love of cartography, of the art of maps, is really so, so deep. I mean, talking to Stuart about a map is just a real privilege, isn't it?
It is. And as somebody who was there standing next to him and rooting through those maps, you can really... It was like a kid in a sweet shop. You know, he was really... You do just gain so much from looking at them, but I gained so much from watching Stuart looking at them as well, which was fascinating stuff. There's loads more from Stuart actually in the coming episodes. Next time, Stuart's explaining LIDAR. You might have heard of LIDAR, but you might not know exactly what it is and how it works, but you'll find out how it can be used to gather even more evidence of the archaeological secrets that a landscape might be keeping.
And still to come, I'm going to be answering the archaeological questions you've always wanted to know the answer to, but you've been too afraid to ask. Dr. Sophie Kay, Time Team's ancestry and genealogy expert, is going to be giving you some advice on how to research your family tree, which is something that all of us do, particularly people like me with a very unusual name. We think, well, it ought to be really easy and simple, but I've had terrible trouble, so I'm going to be listening to that bit.
First, though, here on the Time Team podcast, we want to bring you stories from the world of archaeology, which really interest and fascinate us and hopefully you too. Helen and I have been a little bit obsessed, really, I think it's fair to say, about a recent discovery in King's Lynn. We had to find out more, didn't we, Helen?
Yes, if you've ever found yourself in St George's Guildhall Theatre in King's Lynn, you might have been unknowingly treading over the very boards that the bard himself may once have set foot on.
Yeah, what's believed to be the only surviving stage from William Shakespeare's time has been discovered. These boards are 600 years old.
Now, Tim Fitzhyam is the site's creative director. Welcome to the podcast, Tim.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. Now, I've seen this floor. You very kindly showed it to me. And it is absolutely extraordinary, even if you don't know the history around it, isn't it?
Well, it's a very old building, founded in 1406. It's the largest extant medieval guild hall, we think, in the country anyway. But it has this unparalleled history of theatre. For a long time, I've been secretly hoping that what I could see was the original floor. But it's one thing for me to secretly hope it's the original floor, but it's quite another thing to get archaeologists and dendrochronologists and all the science and documents that we can possibly assemble together to try and say, yes, Tim, that is the original floor. And that's what we were able to do. We got some funding from the Towns Fund. We were able to employ some archaeologists, Dr. Jonathan Clark being one of them, a brilliant buildings archaeologist. And then, of course, we got some help from Historic England to do the dendrochronology that, of course, is science that we desperately need. We really did try and throw the book at it to be able to say with absolute confidence that this is a 1406 floor. And of course, then you've got 600 years of people walking over that floor. And of course, this is the Working Theatre where in 1592-93, we know William Shakespeare's company performed, as you've rightly said. And that, of course, means that these are the boards on which Shakespeare's company would have performed.
So first of all, though, we've got to paint a picture for Martin because he hasn't seen it.
No,
I
haven't.
Can you kind of sum up how it looks? It is just the most amazing thing. It kind of makes you speechless, but describe it for us. Go on, Tim.
Yes, you sort of come up a staircase to an upstairs room in this massive red brick guild hall. The ceiling of the guild hall is original as well. It's a 1406 ceiling, and it's a massive scissor brace oak ceiling. It's the largest, we think, in certainly in Norfolk, and I think we think in the country. And you've got the walls are all 1406 walls with 1406 windows. And then, of course, you've got a 1960s theatre that's been inserted into this guild hall. But underneath the 1960s theatre, you've got a 1950s theatre, and then underneath the 1950s theatre you've got the remains of the 1766 theatre, and then underneath that you've got another floor which is the original floor, the 1406 floor. So it's very like archaeology when you go down through the layers of the mud. It's about the size of a tennis court. It's a really big area of floor. We think it's the largest in certainly in the UK and probably in Europe in terms of original 15th century flooring. So it's a very exciting find generally, and then when you add in the magic of Shakespeare having performed on it, it suddenly becomes really very special indeed.
If that was buried under several layers of floor, how did you kind of know it was there?
So if you go underneath into the undercroft and you can look up, and that's what always intrigued me, was looking up. If you look up at the ceiling of the ground floor, you've got what does look really old and timbery, and it's laid on some very old oak beams as well. And it's just a question around, well, how old is that? That's really what started my mind whirring away as to how old this set of timber floor could possibly be. And I have to say, it's got quite a unique construction, this floor. So it's laid on massive beams, about half a meter by half a meter, that span the entire building. And then on top of that are these very big oak planks, really, and they're sort of lap jointed together like you might lap joint together a ship. King's Lynn, of course, is obviously a port, so it's not a massive stretch to say that we had some shipbuilders around that could have been able to advise in 1406 on how you might put a kind of lap jointed floor together.
And that makes it a most extraordinarily important archaeological discovery. It's not just this is tantalizingly getting us back close to Shakespeare, is it, Tim? It's a theatre in continuous use. It's a floor in continuous use for all that time since 1406. You so rarely get to see something like this that's in situ, that's complete. You can walk into that undercroft, look up, and you see the view of 1406. And that's what's so special. But it's going to tell us so much about theatre history, isn't it?
Exactly right. I mean, you said it beautifully when you were here, when you came to visit us kindly. But you were saying, you know, I made the analogy about digging in holes and how you can dig through buildings. And you said, yes, but when we're digging in holes, we're looking for tiny, weeny clues about, you know, the size of a pinhead. And you've just got to look up and you've got an area the size of a tennis court that you're looking at. The vast clue that we'd all secretly been tiptoeing around and desperately hoping was this incredible rare floor was very visible to us. But it's one thing for me to think that. It's another thing for me to be able to prove that with archaeology and science and all the stuff that we love, to be able to get it over the line and say with confidence, not just Shakespeare, but 600 years of people are walking on that floor.
You really are part of history when you're in that building. What did it feel like when you finally made that discovery and peeled back that final layer?
That's why we opened up the area that we opened up. We chose that area because that's the area that the players would have performed in. It's that tangible link with Shakespeare, and that really tangible link with not just him, but also with the plays, because, of course, the venue itself is linked to one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, of course, Hamlet, in that there's two documents produced in Shakespeare's life that tell us of an event that occurred in the theatre in Lynn, Norfolk. And it tells us that a lady was watching a play called The Murder of Friar Francis. And spoiler alert, Friar Francis gets killed. And she was watching it with her new second husband. And at the point Friar Francis got killed, we're told, she screamed out, "I did it. I killed my husband." And it turned out that she, and the documents say, secretly killed her husband, which has got to be the best way to kill your husband. I think if you're trying to non-secretly kill him, you're on a bit of a loser. But she secretly killed her first wealthy husband to marry her new second husband. And seeing the murder of Friar Francis on stage made her scream out with guilt. We're told she was taken into custody and she was tried for murder. We're then told Shakespeare hears this story and changes the plot of Hamlet. And of course, this leads Hamlet to say one of the most famous lines in Shakespeare, "The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king." And that happened in this very room that the theatre's in now.
So let's hope that that puts King's Lynn on the map. But tell me, Tim, what is next? Because I know that you've done the dendrochronology. I don't know if you've had the results back yet. What's the next steps, and when will you be inviting me up again to come and have a look?
Well, the dendrochronology that we're doing is a vast programme of dendrochronology. We do have the first results in, and that has tied in beautifully with the documentary evidence. So that's always really pleasing. And they're from the vast scissor brace ceiling that I was mentioning earlier. And they date it to 1406. It's totally reversed our understanding of how the documentary evidence and the Guildhall sequenced. And that's the beauty of archaeology, isn't it? When you can apply it to the documents and apply it to the building and then apply that story. And it really does cement the story and get it correct. It gets the order right. So it's really exciting stuff. Next up, we're going to be putting in some test pits, and they're going to be going all over the site. We've got loads of test pits, which are going to be going in really excitingly. And we're going to be doing some more internal building archaeology. And we think there's a target we're aiming at, which may just be the remnant of a building that's even earlier than 1406. But we don't know. It could not be, could be modern, could be anything. Who knows?
Tim, it does sound fascinating. You're going to have to come back on the podcast and tell us how you're getting on with all that amazing research that you're doing. Thank you so much for telling Helen and I all about it.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me. And I just invite everybody to come up to the Guildhall of St George in King's Lynn and come and see it, because it's a very special place.
This is the Time Team podcast, and a little reminder, by the way, that you can learn so much more about lots of archaeological discoveries being unearthed all the time by subscribing to Time Team on YouTube. Every single month, Danny Wootton takes you through some of the most interesting, fascinating archaeological news stories. It is definitely worth checking out.
There's also so much more over on Patreon. We'd love you to support us there so that we can keep bringing you episodes of Time Team. And also, of course, your money will go to supporting a whole host of archaeological projects across the UK and further afield.
Now, later on in the podcast, I am going to be asking Helen some questions. It's those archaeological questions that I've always wanted to know the answer to, but I've been a bit afraid to ask because maybe they seem a little bit silly. But in the future, we really want it to be you on Patreon who asks the question. So if you go to Patreon right now, you can ask Helen a question for a future episode. Patreon.com/timeteamofficial is where you need to go.
Yes, you can ask me anything you like on Patreon, and I'll do my very best to answer everything in the next episode. Oh, that sounds like quite a big ask, but I'll answer your questions certainly in the next episode. But remember, if you want to ask a question and interact with the podcast, then you do need to be a Patreon member. It's kind of like your reward for helping to fund the archaeology. So do go and sign up now.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. Let me bring you a conversation now. It's part one of a longer chat, actually, that I had on a video call with Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor.
Tim's the original founder of Time Team, and together with Mick Aston, he's always been the creative genius behind the programme. And both of them came from a teaching background, and they wanted to use TV to kind of make archaeology more widely accessible, and for people not just to hear about it, but to do it themselves, to get involved. And it's Tim's tenaciousness, really, which has kept Time Team going over all these years. And it's his creativity, which has meant that it's always been quick to keep up with current ideas and with modern media, particularly.
So here's part one then of that discussion, which you'll be able to hear in installments actually over the next few episodes of the podcast. I wanted to go right back to the start with Tim and find out what he was doing before Time Team came along.
Well, for a long time, I was a teacher. I always thought it gave me quite a good experience of trying to deliver what I thought was interesting subjects to groups of kids who weren't always that interested. I then went and did a master's degree and started looking at the prospect of making films in particularly interesting or difficult areas that weren't obvious. So we made a whole series about the world religions for secondary schools in England. It was sort of fly on the wall, I suppose. It had a sort of link to the idea of camera work, which followed what was going on.
And do you remember the moment then that you hit upon the idea of Time Team?
I still have the book with me. A friend of mine came to visit us on Dartmoor, and he bought a book on field archaeology by W.G. Hoskins. He talked about the idea of looking at villages and reading the landscape. And this business of looking at the landscape and reading the past from what you can see was very much what Hoskins began and was subsequently carried on by Professor Mick Aston at Bristol. So this friend of mine left me this book, and I thought this was fascinating. And not far away from where I lived, they were putting in a new reservoir. They found in the soil and in the buildings evidence of a much earlier Anglo-Saxon, early medieval history. I then took the idea of making a series of films about the progress of the archaeology in that valley to Channel 4. Went up to Channel 4, I stuck together a presentation. We didn't have word processing and things like that in those days. And
literally, with the Pritt stick out.
I can show it you, the original stuck-down Pritt-sticked version of what this could be. Before I took that to Channel 4, we'd actually begun to make a number of visits to this valley. One of the archaeologists in the area, the county archaeologist, a chap called Simon Timms, helpfully suggested I should contact Mick Aston. And I went to see Mick. Mick was a fellow Brummie, so I come from Birmingham originally, so we got on very well. We had a long chat about what we might do, and Mick began to come down and talk about the past as we looked at the archaeology. And it was interesting that the process of archaeology had to be done fairly quickly, which was the origins of Time Team's somewhat speedy approach to archaeology. And I said to Mick, wouldn't it be lovely to have someone who would show us how these trees were felled in the past? Mick recommended someone called Phil Harding, and Phil came down and brought with him a polished stone axe and showed us how effectively it could fell these trees. So I had Mick, Phil, would go down there in the rain. There weren't many of us, me, a cameraman, and a couple of people helping and carrying stuff. So Mick used to carry the bags, and Phil would carry a tripod, and we'd all truck down in the rain together, up to our knees in mud. And we'd film there, and after we'd finished, I'd occasionally go and have tea with Mick at the local service station. And we were chatting one time, and he said, I had an interesting time last weekend. I was in a town near Wolverhampton, I think it was. And he said, I'd missed the bus, so I wandered round the town. And he said, I was able to work out the medieval town plan by looking over walls and following roads and everything like that. And I said, so we've been wandering up and down this valley now, and you're telling me that if you had 4 or 5 hours in a village, you could describe the past, what the village looked like. And he said, well, yes. And I thought about this and I said, well, say we gave you everything you wanted. Say we gave you archaeologists, helicopters, everything. What could you do in a weekend? And he said, well, I could give it a go. And I said, right, I'm going to put it together and that's what I'm going to do.
There you go. It seems like the genius for Time Team had been born.
Yes, it's amazing to hear that whole story because I knew bits of it, particularly that bit where Mick missed the bus and wandered around the town looking at the layout. And I think all archaeologists do that when they can. I mean, I particularly love wandering around London, looking at the bits that are medieval and the bits that aren't. But it takes somebody quite different to realise that it actually might make a television programme.
Well, you can find out what happened when Tim took his idea with Mick and Phil to the bosses at Channel 4. That is coming up in the next episode.
Here on the Time Team podcast, Martin and I are giving you the opportunity to find out more about the work done by the various experts that you'll be familiar with if you're a regular viewer of the YouTube channel.
And this time, it's Dr. Sophie Kay, who I'm very pleased to say we can welcome onto the podcast. You might remember Sophie from the Modbury episode. She's Time Team's ancestry and genealogy expert. Sophie, hello.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I think people will be very keen to hear from you, not just because you are a very interesting person with lots of interesting things to say, but I think this plays into what a lot of people are interested in at the moment, because going back and looking at family trees and ancestry is really in vogue now, isn't it?
Oh, in a big way. And I think it's fantastic to see my discipline getting opened up to a bigger and bigger audience of people. Because I think as people realise, you know, when they delve into the stories of their own family's past, it can create some really amazing stories, really amazing narratives. And I think throw up some surprises along the way.
I think a lot of people will be familiar with some of the tools that you might use to do your work. I think, you know, the amateur ancestry family tree creators will know about the 1901 census and that kind of thing. What other tools are available to you, though, to allow you to delve into someone's past?
Oh, where do I even begin? It's one of those wonderful rabbit holes, actually. I think if you really love using historical records, once you get started, you realise that there is an ever-expanding array of things that are becoming digitised for us to look at. Obviously, the census is an amazing, you know, more recent resource that we've got. But even for things like 19th century, there are secondary sources such as trade directories that might list your ancestors and allow you to actually see how they are existing within the community. If you are into buildings history, title deeds can go back way beyond the 19th century and can really start to tell you about the places that your ancestors lived. Every single record you look at, you want to set it in context and say, where did this happen? When did this happen? And can I somehow try and learn about that time and place so that I can step into it and think like a local?
I suppose then knowing where to start is a really difficult bit of it, because if you've got something that's not too far in the past, a couple of hundred years, okay, you've got written records. But when it does go back before that, you do have these other tools available to you, but how do you know which one to start unpicking first?
We tend to find that the further back in time we go, the more and more the survival of records is going to be an issue. Always consult the local archives. Those local archives will have archivists working there who really know their collections and will be able to tell you what specific items have survived for your place of interest. And that can even include one of my favourite resources, historical maps. Go and see if these things are still in existence at a particular local archive, because it's one of those things, it gets very addictive very quickly. I never find it dull because there's so much life in them.
Let's talk about the work that you do when you're with Time Team and are working alongside archaeologists. What sort of things are you able to discover that might help an archaeologist do their work?
Ah, no, what I have loved, particularly with the dig at Modbury, I was, of course, exploring the history of Modbury and its community through the archival records. But obviously, getting to see that alongside the archaeology where you've got physical finds coming out of the ground. One of the many things that we were examining was the Civil War period. For me, one of the really interesting finds was when I went into the accounts for Modbury Parish at exactly that time period. I identified an entry for a local man named John Spinhay, who is being paid to cast 172 pounds of lead into bullets. For me, that was the first time I'd ever seen something that seemed so blatantly militaristic in church records, saying we're paying this man to cast bullets. And so really, it's for me getting to see that administrative side, but then we can actually see how that sits around the archaeology, which is giving us the physical evidence for what was happening in that period.
It really is fascinating. And this is what people want to do themselves, isn't it? This is why. What's your best piece of advice then for someone who is wanting to start that journey into their own family tree?
Ah, now to get started, I would say, and this is something that a lot of researchers I speak to always say they wish they'd done sooner. And that is, if you are in contact with your family, and particularly if you've got older family members, talk to people. There is a wonderful seam of information in a lot of families from what we'd call oral history. Always start from what you know. Initially start by finding birth certificates and, if relevant, marriage records for people in your immediate family. Start to learn about the places that they lived. You can also jump into a fantastic resource for this sort of early years of World War II. It's known as the 1939 Register. Those are core records, which when you take those hand in hand with civil registration, so births, marriages and deaths, those are the sort of core records of genealogical research. My bigger bit of advice would actually be any kind of research generally benefits from talking about it with other people. Chatting to somebody else, it requires you to get your thoughts in order. And I think sometimes that person you're talking to will ask you the important questions about, oh, well, I can see a little gap in your thinking there. How do you know that this person isn't, you know, a cousin that has the same name? And maybe you need to go and do a bit more research to work out whether or not that's the case. Talking to people always helps. It helps us get our thoughts in order, and it draws some interesting questions, which I think is always a welcome thing.
Well, Sophie, I learned so much. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And we'll look forward to chatting to you more, because I think we could chat all day about this sort of stuff. And there's so many questions and so many places to go with it. So you'll have to come back on, and we'll have to have another conversation soon.
Oh, I hope so. I'll look forward to it.
Great. Cheers.
Thanks.
That's Dr. Sophie Kay there. It's interesting, Martin, how Sophie makes that distinction between genealogy, you know, just the bare bones of who's related to whom, and family history, which is the whole big picture. And there's so much research going into family history, and I'd very much like to find some way of stitching it all together, some big research project that can use all that effort to look at trends in things like maybe the movement of people and ideas or something. We really need some big research questions to use all that big effort.
That is such a good idea, isn't it? Because there's so many people who are beavering away at home and in libraries and various different archives up and down the country researching their own family history. But I bet so many of them would get a great deal out of thinking they were part of something bigger, and that their research was contributing to wider research on the topic.
There must be something that we can do with it all. And I think that's something that I want to ask Sophie about.
All right. Well, bear that in mind. And next time Sophie's on the podcast, we can make that happen. It's question time for you now, though, Helen, I'm afraid. Now, normally this would be the bit of the podcast where you get to ask Helen a question. You can do that, by the way, via Patreon. And we'll do that in the next episode. Get your questions. But because it's the first episode, I'm going to ask you some questions to kind of get the ball rolling here and to give you the kind of idea. This is proof, really, that no question is too silly, because I am sure I'm about to ask some very silly questions. Are you ready for this, Helen?
I'm bracing myself.
Okay. I'm going to start you off nice and easy. What's the most useful tool an archaeologist has in their arsenal?
Often the cliched answer to this might be library, but I'm going to say it's the archaeologist's brain, because we've just heard about Stuart and how he looks for patterns everywhere. Well, he's not alone. Every archaeologist's stock in trade is looking for patterns. It's also the questions. What do we think is going on? And what's the evidence for it? And that's really where it helps to have a team, like Sophie said, so that you can get your assumptions questioned. Perhaps what I might say is it's two brains. That's the most important tool. You thought I was going to say trowel. I can tell.
I did think it was good. Or the little brush.
Yes.
Or
yes. But digging is only one part of archaeology. So what I do every day, looking at objects, that doesn't involve any digging. What Stuart does every day, maps, walking over earthworks and so on, landscapes, buildings, there's so much more to it than just digging.
Here's my second question, and you're going to have to forgive me on this one, because I've been trying to think how best to kind of explain what I mean by it. How did the stuff that's in the ground, how did it get forgotten about? How do you go from there being a time where, I don't know, this villa, for example, some Roman villa somewhere, there it is, it's a villa, it's a building, it's up, people walk in and out of it. And then over a huge amount of time, it goes to being something that someone has to discover again. You know, like how did people forget it's there?
That is a really, really valuable question. And it's not a question that archaeologists ever ask each other, you know. We normally say things like, how did they know what was going on in the past? Because a really big thing about research over the last 20, 30 years has been about the reuse of landscapes with prehistoric monuments in them. And sceptics say, well, how did they know they were prehistoric? How did they know they weren't natural? And so our sceptical person says, how did they remember? But you've said, how did they forget? Which is a really fascinating question. For some of it, it's out of sight, out of mind. And in fact, prehistorians and Romanists don't usually worry about this problem, because there are such huge dislocations in society that have gone on, you know, like the Roman invasions and the collapse of the Roman Empire, invasions, pandemics, climate change, all the big things that have happened in the huge long sweep of prehistory. You can imagine that there's a lot of forgetting. There's a lot of people dying without passing on what they know. But how does something like the Royal Burial Ground at Sutton Hoo get forgotten when there's no massive war, there's no massive pandemic? You know, who was the last person who knew what had happened there? And did they try to tell anyone? Or were they just the kind of people who didn't care about the past very much because they were looking to the future, that there was always going to be something better in the future? Why dwell on the past? You thought it was a silly question, but actually no one has ever asked me that before. And I think that's a thing that I'm going to carry on thinking about for a long time. So thank you for that.
Oh, wow. Okay. I thought this, surely that was the most silly question I could possibly ask, but there we go. I won't feel so silly next time. Very, very well answered, Helen. And you're off the hook for this episode now. That's the questions over.
Brilliant. Well, it's been a great set of thought processes for me. The questions are the essential thing that drives your understanding on. So thank you.
That is a pleasure.
So finally, thank you very much for listening to our very first podcast. It's been great to have your company. Mm. Coming up next time, we've got part two of your interview, Martin, with Tim Taylor, Time Team's creator.
Yeah, I've been having a go, Helen, in the big yellow trowel, so you'll be able to hear how I got on. And of course, it is your turn to put your questions to Helen. Do it now on Patreon.
I'm hoping for some really good contributions.
I think it's going to happen. Head over there now. Thank you, Helen. See you next time.
Bye.
And we'll see you again on the next Time Team podcast.